ahead and get started. Good morning. So, my first big question is, what's the difference between chapter 2 and chapter 3?
This morning's quiz.
One's about decision boundaries, and one's about training patterns.
Sure. Good.
I'll just stop there.
No. That's like 90% right now. The last 10% was what was crucial. And how do the two relate to one another? But that's excellent. Usually students don't quite get that this early in the semester. So how are the two related? Why don't we just stop at chapter 2? This is pattern recognition class, right?
Well, because a lot of times you're not necessarily given all the information about the distributions that you see.
Well, how are we going to do? So, chapter 2, we agreed, dealt with classification and decision boundaries and such. How are we actually going to do that? I mean, we need a model, or we need some kind of machine to do that, right? Right? So that machine, give me an example of a machine that will do pattern recognition. We've talked about a few already.
Support vector machine.
A simple what?
Support vector machine.
Well, I mean an algorithm.
Oh.
Oh, like MLE?
Yeah, that, give me one example of the many things we've discussed so far.
Well, let's talk about min-max.
You're sorting salmon and sea bass, and you're using lightness as a feature, and you're going to do what?
Some estimation.
That's too kind. Tell me how you're going to do it. I'm the owner of the factory. I don't understand fancy terms like that. Just tell me how you're going to do it. I give you the fish. I give you the lights. Simplest way. Come on, we talked about this. Don't make it too complicated. You measure lightness. Mm-hmm. You measure lightness for sea bass, lightness for salmon.
You go with the one that's most probable for that.
Okay, so how are you going to build a piece of computer code to do this? Simple. I'm not asking, don't make it too complicated. What's the simplest form of decision making that we've talked about? Gaussian distributions, priors, what are you going to do?
Prior probability. Based on prior probability, you can choose, calculate the posterior probability.
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, but algorithmically, this is going to come down to a threshold decision, right? I'm just going to build a piece of software that makes a threshold decision. And that threshold decision, you need a value for that threshold. If lightness is greater than some number, then choose sea bass, and if not, choose salmon. Where's that number going to come from? What chapter of the book deals with where that number comes from? Chapter 2. No. Chapter 2 is that you're going to do the threshold close. Your chapter 2 is that you're going to do the threshold decoding. And it sort of does define the algorithm, but to get the right threshold, what chapter in the book deals with that? And the answer to that has a very high prior. You got two choices, 2 and 3. 3, thank you. Okay, see how useful priors can be? Chapter 3, we deal with how we actually find the parameters of these models that we're going to build to do classification. And sometimes those models are what we call generative. They try to model the data, the classes, like Gaussian distributions, means and variances and such. And sometimes they're discriminative. They just try to develop a machine that minimizes the error rate directly. And we'll talk about that later. But last class, you talked about how to estimate parameters for simple models like Gaussians, and you talked about how to estimate the mean and variance. And You talked about that in the concept of MAP, maximum a posteriori decoding. Does the touch thing work today? And you ended up with a very simple equation that in the case of an unknown mean and unit variance, you estimate the mean by simply summing up the samples and dividing by n. And that's not surprising. You've known this since about second grade. But here is, you know, as I like to tell students, last semester students got a lot of this. And so this is a concept which comes out in several courses we teach. But, you know, you have to go to graduate school to learn why that's a good thing to do. Previously, you've been doing that, but not really knowing why it's a good thing to do. And then you talked a little bit about the case of unknown mean and variance. And this is another subtlety that we're going to stress in this course. It's a little something that's not often stressed in other courses. That it's all about what assumptions you make about the model. So if you only have an unknown mean, you get one solution. If you have an unknown mean and variance, you get another solution. And that's generally true with most statistical modeling. It's all about the assumptions you make. Now, with Gaussian distributions, fortunately, if both the mean and the variance are unknown, it's still somewhat of a decoupled problem. You can estimate the mean, you can estimate the variance separately. But in other distributions, that's not the case. So it would be important in your real application to decide whether you were just trying to estimate the mean or trying to estimate the mean and variance, because in a complicated distribution, estimation of the mean and variance might require simultaneous solution of some nonlinear equations or something. Now, in the real world, we don't know much of anything, and you have to estimate all this stuff from the data. But we're trying to build up to that with some examples so you get some feel for how these estimates vary. So again, you know, you get this wonderful simple equation that you've probably been using since about third grade. In fact, you can punch that up on your calculators. And I always enjoy when, you know, elementary school kids show me all this cool statistical stuff they do by hitting their little buttons on their calculators. But now you know why this is, in fact, the right equation to be using. Now, when you estimate a parameter, what are some of your concerns about that estimate? So there's many ways to estimate parameters. I've given you some good ways based on maximum likelihood, maximum a posteriori, but of course there's simpler ways, which is just take a random guess. And you'd think sometimes by listening to the news that that's what some political pollsters do. But what are some of the things you worry about from a statistical point of view when you estimate parameters? And when you estimate parameters from large data sets?
How often is it right?
About what?
How often is it right?
Okay, well, it's always wrong. Because, well, I think you have the right concept, we just need to rephrase it a little bit. The chance of getting the exact mean correct is impossible, is zero, because it's a floating point number with infinite amounts of precision. So I think what you're saying is you worry about how close you are to the true value. You worry about the error. And certainly we always worry about the error. What are some other things about that error that we worry about, particularly with respect to the sample size of the data? What do you expect to happen to the error of your estimate as you increase the sample size of your data?
As you increase the sample size, it should go down.
It should go down. If we have a good model, that's a reasonable expectation. So we'll talk about that today. That's called convergence of the mean, convergence of the variance. In addition to, and convergence kind of has two components to it. One is whether your estimator converges to a final value, whatever that value is. And then the second sort of related question is that value close to the true value? Whether your estimator can converge to a value, but it may be the wrong value. So we talk about bias and variance. Bias meaning how far away your final estimate, your converged estimate, is from the true estimate. And variance is the variation of that estimate. And you hope typically that the variance goes to zero. The variance of an estimate can go to zero. It can converge to a final value, but that final value could be off from the true value. So we want both bias to go to zero and the variance to go to zero for a good unbiased estimator. So let's look at the expected value of the ML estimate of the mean, and then we'll also do some things with variance today. Now, one thing I like about chapter 3 is it's kind of estimates on top of estimates on top of estimates. So let's think about what this means. This is the expected value of the mean. The mean is an estimate from the data that we're going to use to do the classification. Once we know the mean, we can create the optimal decision boundary. This is a estimate, not of the mean, but of the estimate of the mean, right? You want to know that as you continue estimating this mean for different sample sizes, that it's converging to the true value of the mean. So we have the expectation of our estimate of the mean. Okay? So it's an expectation of the estimate, which is an approximation to the true value. This is statistics, right? That's why you're here, to learn about statistics. So what is our estimate of the mean? Our estimate of the mean is 1 over n times the sum from I is equal to 1 to n of x sub I. And hopefully as n becomes large, this thing will converge to the true value. But we would also like to show that the expectation of this estimate, sometimes it's going to be above the true value, sometimes it's going to be below the true value. We'd like to show that the expectation of that converges to the true value. So we can take the expectation of this. Well, 1 over n is a constant, so we can pull that out. The expectation of a sum is just the sum of the expectations. So we can write this as 1 over n times the sum from I equals 1 to n of the expectation of x of I. Well, the expectation of x of I is just mu, so we have 1 over n times the sum from I is equal to 1 to n times mu, which just gives us mu. So this is the good news, that the expectation of our estimate converges to the true value. Now, it's a Monday morning, you're thinking, that was just a waste of time, that's kind of obvious. But let's think about this. This actually suggests an algorithm for estimating the mean. In the past, you would have just done this. But maybe if we have a long data set, what we could actually do is to break it into sections, estimate the mean on each one of those sections, and then take the mean of those means. And that's a technique that we'll actually talk about later in the semester as a way to reduce noise and to get at better, statistically more stable estimates of parameters. So that was pretty easy. Now, to do this for the variance, now, remember, this was the expectation of the estimate of the mean. Now we're going to do the variance of the estimate of the mean. Not the variance of the mean, the variance of the estimate of the mean. Now, what do we hope is going to happen with the variance of the estimate of the mean as we increase the sample size?
Should we get some real variance?
No. See? You fell for the trap. You know the answer. Just think about what you just said. This is the variance of the estimate. Well, certainly we would expect that this variance would become smaller and smaller as we increase the amount of data. So let's see what happens to that. So we can take the variance of this random variable, the random variable being the estimate of the mean. We can take that as the expectation of that squared minus the square of the expectation. This is just the sort of standard way we compute the variance in terms of the random variable squared minus the mean squared. So we can write this as E of mu hat squared minus, this is just, we've now shown that this expectation is mu, so this is just mu squared. We can now write out an expression for this mu hat squared. We can write the expectation of the mean times that thing basically squared. And we can then, by rearranging these summations, we can write this as a double sum of the expectation of xi times xj, just sort of reworking this a little bit. So we can write this as 1 over n squared, we can pull out a 1 over n here, 1 over n here, 1 over n squared times this double sum of the expectation of xi xj squared minus mu squared. So that's looking promising because this 1 over n squared is kind of a good term to have there. But we'll now spend a couple slides doing a little bit more work on this expression to get this to a more manageable format. So the expected value of xi xj will be mu squared for j not equal to k, since the two random variables are independent. The expected value of xi squared will be mu squared plus sigma squared, just following our notion of when you have the expectation of a random variable squared and it's not a zero mean random variable. So hence the summation that we had in the previous slide will have n squared minus n terms with expected value mu squared and n terms with the expected value mu squared plus sigma squared. So we can then rewrite that first term in terms of these two terms. One over n squared times the quantity n squared minus n times mu squared plus n times mu squared plus sigma squared quantity minus mu squared. And this, if you just rearrange the terms here, is just sigma squared over n. So this E of mu squared, mu hat squared then, which is the variance of mu hat plus the expectation of mu hat squared, is just sigma squared over n plus mu squared. So we see that the estimate does in fact go to zero as n goes to infinity, and our estimate converges to the true estimate as well. So that's a good proof that the variance of the estimate of the mean is asymptotically unbiased. Okay, so I'll pick this up in the next lecture, but so in this particular section, a couple classes ago, we talked about discrete features, and then we began chapter 3, which is to talk about the reliable estimates of the features. We talked about maximum likelihood estimation, where we treat the parameters as having unknown but fixed values. We're going to see later that Bayesian techniques make a slightly different assumption. And I know at your stage things are a little bit hard to appreciate, but these kinds of assumptions have a lot to do with how you treat the problem statistically. So we'll see that a little bit later. For now it seems kind of obvious, but a little bit later we'll use a Bayesian approach that won't make this assumption. And then we justified some well-known results, and we talked about biased and unbiased estimators, and then we talked about convergence of the mean and variance estimates. So we've essentially proven statistically that these things you've been doing now for a while do make sense, and that's why those relationships are used so frequently and so commonly. So next, we're going to talk a little bit more about the properties of these estimators. And we'll talk about this concept of bias in ML estimates. And then the following class, we'll begin Bayesian estimation. So in the notes, we've just got to I'm going to skip through the review here.
Hello.
This is the thing we covered last. So, when we were dealt with the unknown mean and variance, we showed that the optimal estimate of the mean is just the sum divided by n, and the optimal estimate of the variance is just 1 over n times the sum from k is equal to 1 to n of x sub k minus mu n squared. And these are, again, things you've used now for a while, but it's now you understand that these equations are valid when you're trying to estimate the mean and variance from a set of data that you're assuming to be Gaussian. So, and then we talked about the convergence, the fact that these things do converge to the values that we would expect. And we talked a little bit about the convergence of the mean and convergence of the variance. Now, we want to continue working on our expression. So we'll need one more result related to sigma squared. So sigma squared, let me go back once more. So we're going to continue working on this thing a little bit. So sigma squared, this is the variance of the data with respect to the true mean. Now, that's not something we're ever really going to know in practice, because we never know what the true mean is of the data unless we're using some kind of our simulated data or artificial data. But for theoretical purposes, we can do these kinds of analyses where we ask the what-if questions. What if we knew the true mean? Well, if we know the true mean of the data and we have the data, we can actually then compute the variance by taking the expectation of x minus mu squared. And you may recall we can expand this as just expanding this quadratic, the expectation of x squared minus 2 times the expectation of x times mu plus the expectation of mu squared. And this expectation of x is just mu, so we can write this as the expectation of x squared minus 2 mu squared plus the expectation of mu squared. And therefore, this collapses to the expectation of x squared minus mu squared. Now, this equation you may have encountered in practice, and then we can write this actually in terms of the sample data itself. The sum from I is equal to 1 to n of xi squared for this term and this term. Now, this equation, sort of a digression here, but from a computational point of view, why is this equation of interest to you? This is something I learned when I took my first job, and I was kind of embarrassed that I didn't know this before, but it's something we actually use quite a lot in speech processing. What's the difference between implementing this equation and implementing this equation? If I asked you to compute the variance and you had not, you didn't really think about it much or didn't have a lot of background in this, you'd probably go into MATLAB or whatever and try to implement this equation. The better way to do it is to implement this equation. Why? So if I give you a data set and I ask you to implement this equation, what are you going to do? Right, and what are you going to subtract?
The mean.
And where's that mean going to come from?
From something that you've already estimated. Maybe.
Well, I just give you the data set and I ask you to compute sigma squared. So you're going to have to compute the mean, right? So you're going to do one pass through the data to compute the mean, and then you're going to do another pass to do the x minus mu and then sum of the squares. Now, why is that bad from a computational standpoint if you're using large amounts of data?
You're wasting time.
You're wasting time in what sense?
Well, you have to go through the data.
You have to go through the data. And why on in a large data set on a typical computer is that going to be a problem if the data is not in memory, if the data is on disk?
Slow access.
Going through the data means there's a good chance you're going to page on the computer, or you're going to just have to deal with disk access. and that can be very slow. Sucking all the data into memory, on the other hand, you may not have enough memory to do that. So that's actually not a good way to implement this. This is a much better way to implement it. Why? Because it's something that you can do online, like what we'd like to say is online. You can actually accumulate this term as the data comes in. You can also accumulate this term as the data comes in. And then once you're done, all you have to do is take the difference between the two terms. So this is what you'll see done in a lot of sort of realistic computer code if the algorithm designers were smart. This is what you'll see done in MATLAB. But actually, MATLAB probably does something like this internally. So this implies then that we can sort of reverse this equation and write that the sum of xi squared is equal to sigma squared plus mu squared. So now we can combine these results into our expression for the estimate of the variance. We can write that we have the expectation of 1 over n times the sum of xi minus mu hat squared. This is actually what, if I give you the data set, this is what you're going to be dealing with, because you're going to be estimating the mean from the data itself, and then you're going to plug that mean into the estimate of the variance. I hope people are understanding that, because it's important to appreciate that this may very well compound the error, because you're going to have error in your estimate of the mean, and then that error is going to sort of get compounded by this estimate of the variance, right? So whenever you have a finite data set, you always worry about how accurate your estimate of the mean is, and then how accurate your resulting estimate of the variance is. And the two are related because they're both estimates from a finite data set. Now, we can expand this covariance again using this quadratic form. So we can write that the expectation of 1 over n times the sum from I is equal to 1 to n of xi minus mu hat squared is just 1 over n times the expectation of this quadratic term expanded. We can pull the 1 over n out because that's a constant with respect to the expectation, and just write that quadratic term like we did before. So we have that. This expectation is, we can move inside this summation from I is equal to 1 to n, and we can write the expectation of xi squared minus 2 times the expectation of xi times mu hat plus the expectation of mu hat squared. And remember now, these are expectations of your estimates, not in addition, you know, we've got the actual data here, but these are your estimates as well. So we can write this as 1 over n times the sum from I equals to 1 to n. For this term, we can plug in our true value of the variance and our true value of the mean, because we now have to, we derive this expression. We'll leave this term alone for the moment. And then for mu hat squared, we can write mu squared plus sigma squared over n. Now that leaves us one term that we have to work on, which is this term. So we can look at the expectation of xi times mu hat, and this is going to be the expectation of xi. Well, mu hat is just the sum from j is equal to 1 to n of xj. It's just expressing mu hat as a sum, but we'll use a variable summation j so it's not confused with the I on x sub I. This is 1 over n times the sum from j equals 1 to n of xi xj. And we can also write this as 1 over n times the sum from j is equal to 1 to n of the expectation of xi xj, but when I is not equal to j, plus the sum, plus the expectation of xi xi. That's just sort of a rearranging this sum a little bit. And this we can write as 1 over n. Now this term becomes n minus 1 times mu squared, because we have this I not equal to j, so we're missing one of the terms. And this term is just mu squared plus sigma squared. So this gives us 1 over n times, now we have, again, just sort of rearranging this a little bit by combining these terms, n times mu squared plus sigma squared, or that's just mu squared plus sigma squared over n. So this is again looking promising because this term is going, this piece of this term is going to go to zero as n becomes large. So now we can substitute all this together. We can take this expression, which we had before, and we can substitute the mu squared plus sigma squared over n into that expression. And we can then combine things here. We have sigma squared plus mu squared. We have a minus 2 mu squared over n here. We have, got a little bit lost here. Sigma squared, we have mu squared minus 2 mu squared, which gives us a minus mu squared. We have 2 sigma squared, minus 2 sigma squared over n plus sigma squared over n. Oh, right. And that gives us just sigma squared over n. And then we have this additional mu squared here. So we have sigma squared plus mu squared minus mu squared plus sigma squared over n. So the mu's cancel. And then we just have 1 over n times the sum sigma squared plus sigma squared over n. And this we can rewrite as 1 over n times the sum from I equals 1 to n. We can factor out a sigma squared and write 1 plus 1 over n, which we can in turn write by multiplying both by n. We can write as n plus 1 over n. And since n plus 1 over n is a constant with respect to the summation, we can pull that out and we can essentially write n plus 1 over n times sigma squared. Hesitating a little bit because it looks like there's an extra n here. Which I think... Right. Because we have a sum here, so there's n of these elements. So we have... that n cancels with this n. We just have n plus 1 over n. This is a sum with respect to I. So this is all constant, so there's n of these. And that n cancels with this n. So we're left with this n plus 1 over n times sigma squared. Now, again, that was a lot of work. And you're probably not wondering, what is this? But this is really interesting. Because if you've ever looked into different ways to estimate variances, you've probably seen in some code things like 1 over n times the sum from I equals 0 to n minus 1, or 1 to n. You've probably seen things like 1 over n minus I, the sum from 0 to n minus I minus 1. You've seen these kind of subtle variants on the summation terms. And you might have wondered where those come from. Well, this is where they come from. This says that the variance of the estimate is related to the true variance by this term n plus 1 over n. So if you estimate this using just 1 over n times the sum, you have to deal with a little bit of bias. And this bias can easily be removed by essentially normalizing by one fewer samples. So therefore, the ML estimate is biased because sigma hat squared, which is the expectation of this 1 over n times the sum from I equals 1 to n of xi minus mu hat squared, we just showed that this is equal to that should be n plus 1 over n times sigma squared. Now I'm getting... Well, we had this n plus 1 here, and I'm seeing n minus 1 on the other slide, so I'll have to check that offline.
It's n minus.
I'm sorry?
It's n minus
1. It's n minus 1 on the previous slide. It should be n minus 1, right, but I... we must have missed a minus sign somewhere in here then. I'm sorry?
Third, right?
What? I'm sorry?
Third. Mu square minus mu square plus, that's not plus.
It should be minus?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, but I, because we have minus sigma squared over n here.
And plus sigma squared over n. It is a.
And this is 2, right, yeah, very good. So that should be a minus. I'm sorry about that. I don't know why we, I'll update the notes after class. That should be a minus. Which means this will be a minus, that'll be a minus, that'll be a minus, and that'll be a minus. Very good. So, we have this sigma hat squared is equal to n minus 1 over n times sigma squared, which is not equal to sigma squared. So you can say that the ML estimate is biased in that for n samples, when you compute the variance, you have a slight bias. Now, the good news is, as n becomes large, n minus 1 over n converges to what? Converges to 1. So, for n large, sigma hat squared does converge to sigma squared. That's good news. But this is why sometimes when people compute the covariance, they divide by n minus 1 instead of n. Now there's been a lot of, this is a good example of how theoreticians can sometimes obsess over details. There's been a lot of discussion over the years when you're computing covariances, let's say you're doing something like a linear prediction model or some other statistical model that uses covariance, that it's worth normalizing by n minus 1. If you think about this, the difference between n minus 1 and n is very small. But it's sort of a religious argument as to which form to use. Fortunately, these two are related by this relatively simple equation. So the I've given you some references to some extended discussions of this result. But the interesting thing is that generally speaking in digital signal processing, we don't even do these normalizations. We'll just take for the covariance this term because there's no real need to do those scalings for most algorithms. Most algorithms will sort of normalize out those scalings anyway. In the early days when we were implementing these things on DSPs and compute cycles were of great concern, we would not even worry about these kinds of scale constants. So, but you can, if you ever encounter this form of the covariance, and you'll typically see that in statistics literature, you can now appreciate where that comes from. It's just an attempt to make this ML estimate unbiased. Even though for n large, the difference between the two estimates are very, very small. So I think that's it. So now what we've talked about now up to this point then in chapter 3 is how to estimate parameters using maximum likelihood estimates. And we've talked about how to estimate the mean and the variance. We've talked about the properties of those estimates, the bias, the bias and the variance. And we've talked about the asymptotic behavior of those estimates. Okay, so that's sort of what we covered in this section. Now, the first question is, what's wrong with these ML estimates? Let's sort of go back now to the beginning of the course, where we were talking about ways we could approach these problems. And let's think about, from an information theory or a statistical point of view, what's wrong if I give you a set of data and I ask you to estimate the mean from that data and you use a maximum likelihood estimate for that data? What's the potential weakness of that estimate?
Is it that it didn't regard, I guess, some prior information about the
So, you know, let's think of a real world example. I always like to draw from real world examples on this. I'm drawing a blank on real world examples. I could think of one, for example, that if you wanted to estimate let's say the demographics of Mississippi State students, we could probably use this example. Okay, so one thing you do is you sit outside the door to the Simrall here, the lobby of Simrall, and you simply count people as they walk in the door, right? And from that, you're going to try to estimate the probabilities of Americans or Caucasians and all the other ethnic groups associated with it. Now, what's wrong with that approach? That's actually not a bad approach. I mean, we do this kind of thing all the time. But it has a fundamental flaw.
That based on where you are, like, for example, inside this building, maybe there's some prior probability that you will see some people from some...
Does that approach take into account prior probabilities? Right, just counting. No. So, what are priors can't... So continue. I think you're on exactly the right thread on this.
So I mean, you know, it might be that you have a disproportionate amount of, I don't know, one certain ethnic group within the department that's not being accounted for, so it gives a sort of a biased view of the entirety of the university would be accurate.
Right. So, we have, for many years here, for some reason it's kind of interesting, French players on our tennis team. Like, we have some connection with France or something, and we always end up with a few French players on our tennis team. Are you going to see them if you stand at that door at 8 o'clock in the morning here counting people? No, because they tend not to take engineering classes if they're athletes or whatever. So they're an outlier event. They're a small group, poorly represented in any large sample. And because of other factors which are not necessarily apparent in your model, the likelihood of them showing up at that door at precisely the time you're going to do the counting is small. So you'll estimate the statistics and you come up with a 0% probability for those students. So the problem with maximum likelihood estimates are that they do not take into account priors. And priors can surface in any number of ways. For example, this being the home of the electrical and computer engineering department, there's a higher probability electrical and computer engineering students are going to walk through that door. ECE students tend to be male, so the number of females that you'll count will probably be a bit low. Though we do have class, we share this building with other classes and things. But a better approach might be to stand at the door of this building on Mondays and then go to other buildings on Mondays, also stand here Tuesdays because the type of class is Monday, Tuesday, and all that kind of stuff. So the maximum likelihood estimates that simply sum up the data, they don't take into account that not every one of those data points has an equal likelihood of occurring. Some data, like since we're a university here in the south of the United States, some data, like Caucasians, has a higher probability than some of the ethnic groups. And if you simply draw data sort of equally, you're going to get more samples representing those more probable groups. Your estimates of these parameters are going to be biased by those things that are more probable. And when you're dealing with outlier behavior, when you're dealing with any kind of event that occurs with very infrequently, which is often what we try to do in statistics, you have to be very careful about how you sample if you want to accurately model the edges of the distribution. For example, one of my favorite examples of this is related to a story I read several years ago about there is a sort of legend that about every 500 years a massive tidal wave hits the Seattle area. Now, how many data points do they have on this event? They have actually 3 data points. They've been looking back in history, and you have a problem, right? From spacing of 500 years, you pretty much run out of history. You get back before we even had writing and things like that. So they were looking at analyzing old fishermen's logs, and I think they've been able to go back to either it was 1000 AD or 500 AD, but there's only like 3 data points. But the interesting thing is, now, if that happens today, they're predicting, tens of millions of people would be killed because of that area has become so populated. And this wave has actually gone inland fairly far. They actually can look at sediment markings and things and determine. There's some proof of this. Geologists have been looking at in some of the river basins, looking at this the sediment, whatever they call it, like the sediment profiles and this and that. Now, how do you build a machine to predict something that happens only once every 500 years? Well, that's a really important thing to predict if it's going to cost tens of millions of lives. But you only have 3 estimates. It's sort of purely an outlier type phenomenon. It's so infrequent that you can't really build a model from weather patterns or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, how do you predict this event other than, looking back through history with an end? So Bayesian estimation, which we'll start talking about next class, is really designed to deal with these kinds of issues. And it's a recognition of the fact that prior distributions play a large role in our accurate estimation of these probabilities. Now, it's prior. Remember, we're estimating parameters. We're not classifying data. But it's still the same problem that to get accurate estimates of those parameters, we need to take into account the prior probabilities of the data that we're using to produce those estimates of the parameters. And what was really revolutionary about the Bayesian approach was this idea that instead of assuming all the data is equally probable, we're going to make some assumptions about the probability distributions of the priors and try to actually estimate those probability distributions as part of the estimation process. So we're going to add yet another estimation problem, which is estimation of the priors. And then typically what we will do with the Bayesian approach is we will try several different models for the priors and then look at how that influences the overall results and then make some do some inference based on the collection of those models. So we will talk about that next class, but we're sort of getting further and further disconnected from reality, you could say. I mean, we're building estimator on top of estimator on top of estimator, but it's really important and it's really interesting stuff, and the Bayesian approach has become very, very dominant in the literature because we can generally do a little bit better than simply a maximum likelihood approach where we ignore priors on the data. Okay, we'll stop here.